Hello and welcome to the GSC Grey's Forestry Industry Podcast. Today I'm joined by David Gray, who is the chairman of GSC Grey's. I'm joined by Ian Robinson of Scottish Woodlands and joined by Richard Powell of the Forestry Commission. Today we are hoping to discuss the opportunities and challenges that are facing the forestry industry, both at the moment and over the coming years, with the introduction of the environmental land management schemes together with the government's planting targets over the coming decades and how the industry is going to react to those challenges and targets. So to start us off, there has been a recent announcement in the last couple of years from the government of its target to plant 30,000 hectares of woodland per year between now and 2050 in a route to reach net carbon zero. There have been some challenges in reaching this to date. What do you feel the main challenges are that we've met in the first couple of years of this plan?
It's worth recognising that the target is to gradually ramp up to the rate of 30,000 hectares a year across the UK by 2025. And then to sustain that rate thereafter. So it was never the intention to go from the low base that we were at historically to 30,000 hectares kind of overnight. That would have been unrealistic in terms of the capacity of the sector and the speed with which land use decisions are made, etc. But sure enough, we do have a mountain to climb because, you know, for those of you that aren't close to the kind of level of woodland that has been created in England over the last few years, what we're talking about is a four or five-fold increase in the amount of woodland created in England every year from 2025. So it's an ambitious target, but nevertheless, I think it's essential if woodland creation is going to play a full part in helping government reach the legal commitment of carbon neutral by 2050. In terms of your question, you know, the challenges so far, there's a whole host of challenges. You know, nursery capacity needs to gear up, so we've got the plants. Owners and agents, probably one of the most important things, need to be informed, enthused, carefully advised, you know, to make the right sound decision for them, you know, and having the capacity to do that, both in terms of, you know, companies like Grays and other companies of land agents and advisors, but also from the public sector, for us to be able to feed you that information to relay. That obviously takes a little while to gear up. And then there's this massive challenge associated with uncertainty, I think. You know, we know basic payments are going. We know the environmental land management scheme is on the way, but people are responding to that uncertainty in different ways. Some are doing very little until there's more certainty, but some are going for it in the sense that because they're uncertainty, they're wanting to make a start and kind of take control themselves, you know, take control of their own destiny, as it were.
But Richard, I think, you know, whilst I get the issue with regards to numbers of plants and that can be sorted, the other issue that I come across, and I'm sure Ian will have a comment on, is this conflict with ground nesting birds, with landscape, with peat. And you talk to the national parks, you talk to the ONBs and other people that have vested interest in the land. And you can have this most marvelous bit of land that's pretty useless from an agricultural point of view, but it's absolutely fantastic for curlews or lapwings or whatever. Or it has that peat depth, which means that we can't plant on it. And it's useless from an agricultural point of view. And I'm sure, Ian, you've come across sort of a number of examples of that already, have you?
Yes, very much so. And I think mainly in the context of Scotland, because there's not been a lot of new woodland creation in the north of England yet anyway. But certainly in Scotland, you know, these constraints are well known, but I think one of the problems in England is just the confidence in landowners and land managers. There's been no large scale afforestation in England for a number of years. There's been a few recent schemes which have been very high profile and, you know, have caused some issues which have kind of slowed down the process, thinking of Donnacht and North Moor in particular. But it is an issue of confidence, and confidence in the approval process, confidence in how the consultation is going to go. Will there be any showstoppers? You know, and by showstoppers, I'm talking about, you know, deep peat, etc., landscape issues. I mean, all of these things can be addressed on an issue of scale. I mean, most larger sites will have some sort of constraint, but that can be accommodated in the design. The problem comes when you've got a more modest sized proposal and there's a constraint which really restricts that opportunity. But I mean, there's plenty of experience there in working through the system. It's just going to take everyone, including Forestry Commission, Richard, you know, will agree with this, everyone needs to have a bit more confidence in what they're doing and get a few schemes completed under the belt, and then things will evolve, I'm sure.
Yeah. I mean, it is a challenge, David, undoubtedly, because there's this paradox. The land of least value in terms of its economic value tends also to be that land of highest conservation value. So the areas that you would be attracted to plant trees on, because they're of low agricultural productivity, they don't really contribute much to the farm account or estate account, are very often just those areas, as you've said, that are priority habitat or that are areas important for breeding waders like curlew or have some deep peat or whatever. And we're dealing with that on a day-to-day basis. You know, we've, as Ian said, we're now benefiting from the experience of several larger schemes where we've had to accommodate those constraints within the design. But we've done it. And what we're really keen to do to build this confidence, as Ian's saying, is missing, is to share those as case studies, to share the learning that we all went through for others to benefit from. I think the other comment I would make is that what we have to remember is that we have both a climate and a nature crisis, and the 640 million that the Chancellor announced some time ago for the Nature for Climate Fund was to address both of those things. It's not just about carbon, it's also about nature. And I guess what that means is that whilst traditionally you might put in something close to 70% Sitka spruce, that's not happening now, at least not in England. You know, we're encouraging greater species diversity, we're encouraging more open space, we're encouraging the use of native broadleaf. So you get commercial benefit, yes, but you also get benefits for nature. And importantly, you don't have an adverse effect on those protected species that we're legally obliged to protect.
But Richard, do you think there's a need to kind of streamline the planning and application process to try and build people's confidence? There must be a synergy there somewhere.
In a word, yes. and we're looking to do that. Yeah, I mentioned earlier that there's a number of new grants, new incentives coming on stream. But what we're also really conscious of is that, you know, there's money on offer that I think Ian would agree is often enough to persuade a landowner to take that decision to go down the forestry route. But often what the problem is that it can take sometimes as much as 2 years from making an initial inquiry to getting trees in the ground. And it can cost quite a lot of money in terms of all the surveys and the negotiation and the consultation and the working with stakeholders, you know, and then you end up with something quite often, you know, to be frank, that's not quite what you originally intended, not quite what you did your original financial calculations on. I mean, Ian's got loads of it. Ian and his team have got loads of experience with this. However, we are looking to work out how we can reduce the time it takes, make it simpler, make it slicker, but of course at the same time honour the obligations we've got as part of DEFRA to safeguard the natural environment. So we're trying to find that sweeter spot where it's better than it is now, but we very definitely want to be in a place where we couldn't be accused of riding roughshod, for example, over our responsibilities towards nature. So in designing the new England Woodland Creation offer, we're bringing down the area threshold to just 1 hectare per application, and we're bringing down the minimum block size to 0.1 of a hectare and accommodate smaller scale shelter belts within the scheme as well. We're also trying to simplify it as far as we can and speed up the process. So the new offer will be managed start to finish by the Forestry Commission. So you'll just be dealing with, you know, the local woodland officer or the woodland creation officer. So the new offer will be more flexible, simpler and quicker. And we're really optimistic that in launching this new scheme in May, we'll have a good number planted next planting season. I think the other thing to bear in mind is that we absolutely recognise, particularly in the context of the more upland areas of the north of England, that the value of shelter on farms and the contribution that a well-sited shelter belt can make with respect to stock husbandry and welfare, and even things like grass growth rates. So as a result of that, we're also thinking about, well, we're not thinking about, we are going to provide confidence for those owners that are new to forestry to kind of dip their toe in the water.
I think the application process has been criticised in the past. It's certainly improved. In my experience, it's certainly improved in the last few years, bearing in mind a lot of my experience was actually in Scotland, because that's where the vast majority of the UK's new wooden creation has been happening in the last sort of 5 to 10 years. What could improve it further? I suppose the consultation process and better control of the consultees, statutory consultees and NGOs, to ensure that only those that are relevant need to be consulted. And secondly, that those that are consulted stick to the timetable. One of the main problems you have with the consultation process and dealing with NGOs and other statutory consultees is the fact that, you know, they don't reply to requests timeously. And the whole process can drag over months and months because you're still waiting on someone to respond. I mean, that would certainly help.
I think you're right. I think you're right, Ian, that you know, Scotland, you know, my perception and GSC Greys don't do an awful lot north of the border. We've tended to restrict ourselves in England, and therefore my focus has very much been on England and planting schemes in England and the approach and, dare I say, bureaucracy that seems to surround the whole application process as we sit at the moment. And I sit on the Northern Upland Chain LNP, which covers a big swathe of the north of England, and particularly a big swathe of the area of land that we're involved with from a management point of view. And yes, apart from the time gap, it's all designated. But it is that land that is less attractive from an agricultural point of view. And my concern in England is that we have a finite amount of land that's available for this. And I've had discussions with various people over, you know, where do you plant 30,000 hectares in the UK, acknowledging the fact that only so much can go in Scotland, so much can go in Wales. We do need a proportion of it in England. And it would be quite interesting, Richard, to hear from you, sort of, you know, of the 30,000 hectares, where do you see that being planted in England?
Yeah, okay. So, as you say, the 30,000 hectares per year is a UK target. It's likely, this has not been confirmed, but my best guess would be that the England target might be 7,000 or 8,000 hectares of that. Where we are getting a good number of large-scale applications at the moment, and I think this trend will continue, is not on the poorest land, and it's not on the best land. It's on that kind of grade four, often permanent pasture, improved, semi-improved land that's currently carrying beef and sheep, not in designated areas. And my guess is that with the decline in basic payment scheme, and the way in which the future environmental land management scheme may be targeted, it is that land that will be increasingly less viable for agricultural productivity and increasingly more viable for forestry. And the benefit of that land is that not only is it more fertile and less windy than the hill land that forestry has traditionally taken. And that brings benefits in terms of growth rates and species choice flexibility and potentially reduced risk to disease because you're getting trees in a non-stressed environment, et cetera, et cetera. So there's benefits from that point of view. But there's also benefits because there's far less conflict on that land with those most interested in nature conservation, because often that land simply doesn't carry the level of conservation interest that the priority habitat or the designated areas does carry. So I think we need, the phrase bringing forestry down the hill is often used, but I really do think that's important. And we're wanting to do some proactive work on that. I mentioned earlier that we're recruiting a lot more staff. One group of staff that we're recruiting is will work to the head of promotion and engagement. And there'll be promotion and engagement staff in each of the Forestry Commission areas across England. And part of their task will be to work with you, David, and you, Ian, and people like you to discuss where you think the opportunities are, and we'll suggest where we think those opportunities are. And I'm hoping that that might help identify the sort of land that's, as I say, at that kind of sweet spot in terms of not highly valued agricultural land, but not highly valued for conservation either, and the land that's less likely to be attracting the kind of level of subsidy that it has attracted historically that supported the agricultural economy. And we want to map that. So essentially, agents will be able to have a look at those maps and, in simple terms, see whether they're the particular estate or farm they're concerned with is in a red area, an amber area, or a green area. But hopefully that'll give an indication of where this woodland will or should best come from.
So your point about bringing woodland down the hill, does that therefore mean that we're going to have more of a focus on broadleaf species in the UK rather than softwood species and less of a focus on supporting our own timber market?
Yeah, well, I suppose I've got personal opinions about the UK, but I can really only speak for England. Yeah, clearly, you know, if we were going to address the nature crisis as well as the climate crisis, we do need lots more native woodland. You know, we need to get back to the former natural vegetation on more of our land than currently carries that former natural vegetation. But equally, if we're going to sequester carbon rapidly, we need to plant conifers, you know, because in the very simplest of terms, the faster a tree grows, the more carbon it locks up in carbohydrate in wood, the more carbon is captured. So it's not an absolute indicator, but yield class is a reasonable surrogate for the speed with which carbon is captured. So there's a strong carbon element for including a proportion of that total as conifer. But there's also an argument in terms of supporting jobs and rural economies and moving away from a system that kind of constantly requires injection of public cash to one that will wash its face and stand alone, be entirely financially viable without the injection of public money. And a new kid on the block that is really important in that respect is the money that's now beginning to come forward as a result of corporates' interest in offsetting their carbon emissions.
Richard, isn't that part of the problem that we now have? Because we're sitting there seeing this money beginning to dribble in, question marks over the Woodland Carbon Code and everything else and exactly, you know, what that means and whether it's fit for purpose or not. But then as a land manager or as an estate owner or as a trustee that's involved in an estate or whatever, mm-hmm. one's sitting there saying, well, this money's beginning to trickle in. What's it mean? How's it actually going to work? And if I jump now, if I go and plant my trees and bits and pieces, am I going to miss out on the future with regards to either carbon or the requirement for biodiversity offsetting, net gain, and all these sort of in vogue phrases that are coming through that people are picking up? Because I'm noticing that a lot of my clients are turning around and saying, well, what's it all mean? What should I do? And at the moment, to be entirely honest, we don't know. And I think that you know, one thing that, that comes to mind with regards to this timing and everything else is you refer to a climate crisis and you refer to a nature crisis. Not being too dramatic, but there must be the beginnings, and this is probably a question to Ian, there must be the beginnings of a bit of a timber crisis. And there just isn't the timber there, I think, Ian. Are you noticing that across the board?
Yes, I mean, timber prices have peaked just in the last month or so. But to be fair, timber prices have been very strong for the last 7, 8, 9, 10 years, relatively speaking. And that's it's simply due to supply and demand. You know, timber is a world traded commodity, and we're homegrown timber is competing against imported timber, depending on the exchange rates, depend on the price of imported timber. At the moment, imported timber is very expensive. World demand for timber is increasing all the time as the developing countries need more timber, want to keep their timber, which they've traditionally exported, to keep it themselves. Russia have banned the export of round timber because they want to add value by processing it themselves and selling sawn timber. You know, you mention a country in the world, they're all using more timber than what they used 10, 20 years ago. And to be fair, that's a good thing for UK timber growers, UK timber processors, because they're capturing more market share. I mean, we're barely 20% self-sufficient in our own timber production. The good thing about forestry is you can actually have the best of both worlds. You know, you can plant multi-purpose forests with a wider range of species, conifer and broadleaf. You can grow timber for profit, and you can secure carbon money as well. So you can literally have your cake and eat it if you actually go about things the right way. I mean, we're doing a lot of new wooden creation, you know, in the UK, predominantly in Scotland, but we're starting to see more interest from landowners in the north of England on the type of land that Richard described, sort of grade four land, the sort of land that's been sort of, you know, maybe sort of had a go at cultivating, it hasn't worked out, and currently it's got sheep on it. You know, we're seeing a lot of interest in that. And that sort of land, you can plant a wider range of species than what you traditionally plant on hill. And the carbon money is starting to flow. I mean, it's probably better in England than it is anywhere else because you've got the Wooden Carbon Guarantee, which is a government-backed system where you can auction your carbon units. And that's sort of giving a footing to the market, which is developing quite nicely.
So, Ian, just to clarify, you're not finding a conflict between planting for timber production and planting for environmental benefits and carbon offsetting?
Not necessarily, no. I mean, you can do both. Up until very recently, you couldn't plant commercial conifer species and sell the carbon units, but that has now changed. Obviously, if you're going to fell the trees, there's going to be less carbon sequestered over the longer term, depending on your rotation length, but they still have a value. Most of the areas that people are planting with native woodlands are not going to be commercial, you know, commercial plantations. You know, that it's effectively habitat creation as opposed to a commercial enterprise. And okay, they might produce a little bit of firewood, but that's probably about it.
Mm. But the revenue stream there, Ian, is the carbon money, is it not?
It is, but if you can get the balance right, Richard, you can get carbon money income and you can ultimately get timber income at the end of your conifer 40, 50 year rotation as well. And then the cycle can be, you know, the cycle's then repeated. An element of the carbon from the timber that's sold is still going to be stored if it's going in, you know, if it's going into construction. It's not going back into the environment. It's being sequestered in the longer term. And then you obviously replant and start the process again.
Yeah. And I agree with you, David, in terms of there's still a lot of, well, confusion probably and uncertainty about carbon and trees and woodlands. And I totally get that. But again, I think it's down to sharing the learning from the pioneers, if you like, those that have already created new woodland, those that have registered with the Woodland Carbon Code. And, you know, so far as we can to, you know, to get at least some of those people to kind of open their books up, to provide to others the kind of real live examples, the kind of case studies that I talked about earlier that I believe personally are really important to build confidence. Because, you know, as land managers, I think we're largely quite a conservative bunch, aren't we? You know, we tend that the sense is that we very largely do what's worked in the past, and we think very carefully about doing something that could be seen as quite radical or different. And I totally get that,
Richard. One of the problems you have with a tree is that once you plant a tree, it's effectively always a tree. So from that change, you know, from a land use point of view, you know, you go back and, you know, you go back into the 50s or 60s, and we had lots and lots of mixed farms and dairy farms and bits and pieces all over the north of England. And particularly in the northeast, we've seen a huge demise of particularly lowland sheep, beef and dairy are more or less extinct now. And that was all on the back of arable area. It was very easy to switch into plowing stuff out, growing your wheat, your barley and other bits and pieces. Fences deteriorated. That has caused a bit of a problem with people wanting to go back into livestock. But we have seen a move back into livestock over the last sort of 10 years or so on some of that more marginal ground. But if one then decides, right, we're actually going to stop, in inverted commas, farming four-legged things, or arable crops, and what we're going to do is we're going to plant a tree, we're then a tree, and we then find that when we want to fell that tree, we have to replant it. Now we may be able to negotiate not replanting it on exactly the same spot, and we may be able to move it somewhere else, but we are required to plant a tree. So it's a big decision going down the route of planting trees.
I agree. I mean, I'm fortunate to have a little bit of land of my own now, and you know, when I got here I thought, right, I'm gonna plant it with trees, but you know, even I'm thinking long and hard about that. Think long and hard, take lots of advice, weigh up your options, talk to probably more than one advisor, talk to other people that have done it. I guess it's like making any other decision in life that is permanent or near permanent. It's not something you go into lightly, and I understand that. There's a couple of ways that we're trying to reduce the kind of risk at the moment. But with respect to reducing the risk in terms of, I'm actually a farmer. I don't have a huge amount of forestry expertise. I don't really understand or get forestry. So on the 31st of March, Forestry England made an announcement about how they're coming back into the woodland creation arena. And what they're offering is actually very, very simple. We're saying to farmers and landowners that if you've got at least 50 hectares of land and you're content that there'll be public access on that land, Forestry England will do everything for you. We'll do all the planning and get it through EIA and the consultation, and we'll create a woodland for you, and we'll pay you a rent every year. So all the farmer needs to do basically is sign the paper and collect the rent. And that agreement will last for somewhere between 60 and 120 years. So, you know, if it were conifer, as you know, a lot of these schemes, I think, will be mainly conifer in the north. We're talking perhaps two rotations. This isn't new. The Forestry Commission has been leasing land from landowners for a long, long time. And we have a lot of very long leases, as I'm sure you know. But, you know, I think we felt as an organisation that as the single largest landowner in the country, we had something to bring to the table to help government achieve the woodland creation ambition.
When that scheme was announced, Richard, was consideration given to the sort of the capital taxes position of that land if you do enter into one of these agreements and get an annual rent back? You know, at the moment, your agricultural land qualifies for agricultural property relief if it's let, or business property relief if it's farmed in hand. If you've then got an investment effectively and you're being paid a rent, what guidance has been given by the Capital Taxes Office to you in relation to the treatment of that land subject to one of those agreements?
In short, I don't know personally, but the scheme's been developed by James Lee and other land agents that work for the Forestry Commission. So I'm confident that it'll have been thought about, but I don't know the answer to that specific question. I think that would be something that you would need to pick up with Jim or one of his colleagues.
You also have the challenge, though, that you talk about a farmer that's perhaps coming to retirement and looking to change out of farming and look for a more permanent change. A minimum area of 50 hectares is quite a lot of land when you consider the areas that would need to be taken out that are deep peat, that are protected areas, that have got protected species on them. So the chances of finding a 50 hectare area of woodland that is conveniently on a ring fenced owner's land is potentially quite small. And therefore you're having to reach the minimum of 50 hectares. You're probably having to join up two or three neighbouring landowners that are conveniently all at the same point of their life.
I mean, I think what might happen is that you'll have a single landowner, but you might have two or three neighbouring tenanted farms. I have three cases in mind where my colleagues in Forestry England are talking to owners already with that kind of scenario. One's a large corporate, not a farmer, but the land is being farmed. One is a large-scale energy producer, again, not a farmer, but the land is tenanted. And the other one is currently an arable farm and fairly large, but I suppose you describe it as marginal arable, not best and most versatile land. And in all of those situations, you know, it's been very easy to assemble more than 50 hectares of land. In fact, in all three cases, it's likely to be over 100 hectares.
So if we move away from what we've discussed of recently, given the increased uptake of woodland planting that we're expecting, Ian, it'd be interesting to hear your thoughts on, firstly, the future of the timber market with all the increased planting. Obviously, you know, when we reach rotation one, for example, and additionally, given what we were previously talking about with the higher import costs of the international timber trade, how the UK sawmills are going to be able to adapt to the increased input.
The UK wood processing industry has invested strongly in the last 10, 15 years to deal with the forests that were planted in the 70s and 80s maturing. The supply situation is now plateaued, and it will decline because of the lack of new woodland creation between sort of 1990 and sort of 2015, let's say. But I mean, if they need to invest to increase their capacity, they will do, because they want to maintain or gain their market share in the international marketplace. So I would have no concerns about the ability with the wood processing industry to deal with increased timber if and when that comes along. You've got to remember as well that, you know, 50% of the new woodland creation in the UK is likely to be of native species. Mm. And if the target's 30,000 hectares, there's going to be 10,000 hectares of that native species, and they will not produce any timber, really. You know, they might produce a bit of firewood, but they're probably not going to be managed in a way so that they'll produce quality timber regardless of the rotation length. So the timber production is going to come from 50% of what's actually planted. And we're talking about gross areas here as well. I mean, the 30,000 hectares is not 30,000 hectares of trees. It's probably 25,000 hectares of trees, actually, by the time you take out the areas of designed open space within these plantations. So I wouldn't have any concerns regarding the ability of the industry. The concern may be in the short term on actually sourcing the trees to plant these woodlands, but not necessarily in the market, in the processing of timber in the future.
So it was mentioned earlier that at the moment we've only got about 20% of our current usage in the UK, and that we rely on kind of 70 to 80% of international timber. With the increased planting, how much are we expecting the UK supply to the UK timber market reaching? Are we expecting to see 40, 50, 60% of our supply demand?
No, I think you'd be lucky to get 30%.
Ultimately, Ian, the real challenge is to actually maintain the 20%, isn't it?
Well, it is, yes. Yeah. I mean, we haven't got enough land in the UK to produce crops and be self-sufficient. To be anywhere like self-sufficient in timber and still being able to feed ourselves, basically. So, I mean, we're never going to be self-sufficient. If we increase the 20% to 25%, everyone would probably quite happy. I mean, the UK is actually probably producing 12, 13 million tonnes of timber per year. That's roughly what we're actually producing at the moment. And I suppose if that could creep up to about 15, that would be a good result.
Mm. And if you have invested slightly more into the commercial timber aspect, we're hearing quite a lot of disease aspects at the moment. I think Phytophthora is probably the main one on people's lips, alongside certainly from a native species, yak dieback. What things can people do when they're designing a scheme and planning a scheme that reduces risk from those potential diseases?
Well, you take advice in the first instance on what are the right trees for the site. Obviously, depending on your site will very much depend on the range of species you might plant. But obviously, the owner's objectives are key in this as well. But if you've got an owner who wants to plant trees for commercial reasons, probably going to go down the softwood route. The further down the hill you plant on better land as opposed to upland land, gives you a wider range of species. But I mean, there are, we're not talking about 10 or 20 different species, we're talking about half a dozen different species at best. That diversity, not putting all the eggs in one basket, will help. But the other thing which will help is vigilance. People need to be managing the woodlands proactively, looking for problems, and then trying to address the problems at the very earliest stages. I mean, in the UK, pest and diseases are not new. But we've had quite a mixed success in how we've dealt with them. We've been very successful in dealing with some of the spruce bark beetles, which are not non-native exotic pests which have been introduced in the UK. We've been very good at those. We've been less good at keeping a track on things like Phytophthora and Chelara. But I mean, vigilance is key. If there is an outbreak, it needs to be dealt with. Like they can all animal husbandry as well. If there's an issue with some sort of disease affecting your stock, it's better to sort it out on day one than wait and see what happens.
As a final point, Ian, it would be quite interesting to hear your final comments as a woodland manager. It'd be interesting to hear your comments for those people that are looking to go into forestry as a diversification for their estate or farm. Just your final thoughts and advice that you'd give to them when they're first considering it.
Yeah, I think I would wind the clock back a little bit. 1987, when I started my career, the first thing that happened was the Chancellor of the Exchequer changed the rules, which basically meant that commercial forestry ground to a halt in the UK overnight. We fast forward 23, 24 years, and the forest industry is booming. There are good incentives for new woodland creation. The grants effectively cover the costs, so you're getting your woodlands more or less for nothing. If they're well designed and have an appropriate element of productive species in them, you've got a capital asset which is growing in value. I mean, the sale value of woodlands have never been higher than what they are now, and there's no sign of that slowing down. Carbon has entered the equation as a new income stream. Now, where we're going to go with that, we don't really know. I mean, 2 years ago, carbon units, which is the amount of CO2 which is sequestered per hectare, basically over the life of the crop, I mean, they were worth £2 or £3 a unit 2 years ago. Now, they're worth prices in the mid to high teens, over £20. And you've got the Financial Times saying that the price could be quadrupled within the next 12 months. That there's a lot of money to be made from carbon. Our advice to clients when they're planting trees is plant trees for whatever objectives that you want to plant trees for. Register your tree planting with the Woodland Carbon Code, and sit on the carbon units because the prices are only going one way. Now, there'll be a point in time when it will be right to sell your carbon, but our advice is not to sell at the moment because the prices are only heading upwards. So, I mean, there's never been a better time to be involved in forestry, whether you're a forestry professional like myself, whether you're a landowner thinking about diversification, whether you're a farmer thinking about diversification. Forestry is a viable option if you want to diversify your land holding.
Thank you very much for that final point, Ian. And also thank you very much to David and to Richard for your involvement today and your knowledge and your experience that you've offered. If you'd like any more information on the forestry industry or how to access forestry onto your estate or farm, then please do feel free to get in contact and hopefully we will be able to be of assistance to you. Thank you very much for joining us, and I hope you have found the conversation we've had today interesting.